The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we're reading from The Week magazine, dated July 5th through July 12th. They'll be taking a hiatus for the holiday after the July 4th celebration. As usual, we'll begin with the main story section of The Week magazine, and their first article here is entitled, A Turning Point on Gay Marriage. The Supreme Court struck a historic blow in favor of gay rights this past week, nullifying a federal law that defined marriage as a union between a man and a woman, and letting stand a ruling permitting same-sex marriage in California. In a bitterly divided 5-4 ruling, frequent swing vote Justice Anthony Kennedy joined the court's liberal wing to strike down parts of the Defensive Marriage Act, called DOMA, as unconstitutional under the Equal Protection Clause. The ruling means that the federal government must recognize gay marriage in the 12 states where it currently is legal, allowing same-sex married couples to file joint tax returns and receive federal benefits linked to marriage status. In his majority opinion, Kennedy wrote that the 1996 law was motivated by a congressional desire to harm a politically unpopular group and improperly undermined a state's decision to extend the recognition, dignity, and protection of the marriage contract to same-sex couples. In his acerbic dissent, Justice Antonin Scalia said the jaw-dropping ruling was an outrageous exercise in judicial activism and would inevitably be used to attack every state law restricting marriage to its traditional definition. In the California case, the court ruled 5-4 that proponents of Proposition 8, a referendum that banned gay marriage in California, had no legal standing to challenge a lower federal court decision. That decision had voided Proposition 8 as unconstitutional. So the court decided, in effect, to reinstate same-sex marriage in California without taking on the broader question of whether 37 other state laws banning gay marriage are constitutional. Now here's what the editorial said. The Supreme Court has placed itself on the right side of history, said the Kansas City Star. Striking down the noxious Defense of Marriage Act entitles legally married gay couples to all the benefits their heterosexual counterparts enjoy, from tax breaks to military and retirement benefits. But the court missed a historic chance to establish a nationwide right for gay people to marry, said the New York Times. Perhaps the court thought that the country is not ready, but the momentum for marriage equality seems unstoppable. The California decision does mean the state-by-state ground war on same-sex marriage will go on, said USA Today. But the court acted wisely in going slowly. Leaping too far ahead of public opinion could cause an ugly and prolonged backlash, like that triggered by Roe v. Wade. This journey may be bumpy and slow, but rest assured the court will eventually take a firmer grip on the controls. Now here's what the columnist said. Let the lawsuits begin, said Richard Sicarides in NewYorker.com. Although the court's punt on Proposition 8 may be seen as somewhat of a disappointment, the court's establishment of an equal protection test for DOMA will be an important precedent for challengers of state laws banning same-sex marriage. In the ringing language of equality, Justice Kennedy has stated it's unconstitutional to treat gay people as second-class citizens simply because of animus against them. And Greg Sargent in WashingtonPost.com, that provides a whole new framework, legal framework, to challenge state laws which are now on the path to extinction around the country. The fight isn't over yet, said Ryan Anderson in NationalReview.com. The court deliberately chose not to create a right to the definition of marriage in California, meaning that conservatives can still protect the true traditional meaning of marriage at the ballot box. Let's face it, the right has lost this battle, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. In less than two decades, there's been a fundamental shift in American culture in which gay people and gay marriage have become normalized. Gay marriage advocates won the culture war, which is why they're now winning the legal war. The question now is how long it will take for the final breakthrough ruling, said Gabrielle Arana in Prospect.org. History suggests that the Supreme Court often takes decades to complete such tectonic shifts. But with public opinion on gay rights evolving at breakneck speed, the last barriers to gay marriage may fall in a matter of years. The next item from the main story section is Voting Rights Act gutted. The Supreme Court struck down a core component of the 1965 Voting Rights Act this past week, ruling in a 5-4 vote that Congress can no longer require nine mostly southern states to get federal approval before changing their voting procedures. Under the Act, a keystone of civil rights-era legislation, jurisdictions with a history of racial discrimination had been required to have any change in their election laws or practices pre-cleared by the federal government. While the court left that requirement in place, it rendered it essentially obsolete by ruling that the provisions that identify which jurisdictions the law covered were out of date. Congress reenacted a formula based on 40-year-old facts having no relationship to the present day when it renewed the law in 2006, wrote Chief Justice John Roberts for the majority. Our country has changed. In response to the judgment, Texas and Mississippi vowed to immediately implement voter identification laws that had been subject to federal approval. President Obama declared himself deeply disappointed by the ruling, which he said upsets decades of well-established practices to help make sure that voting is fair. What a travesty of justice, said Heather Gerken in Slate.com. Before the civil rights movement, almost no African Americans were registered to vote in the Deep South, not because they didn't want to, but because they were prevented by brutal repression and sickening legal chicanery. Obstructed by arbitrary literary tests, poll taxes, and unfair registration requirements, activists fought and died for protection under the 1965 Voting Rights Act. We should mourn its passing. But we live in a different era, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. These states now look nothing like the Jim Crow South that Congress put under the microscope five decades ago. In fact, African American turnout in five of the six southern states covered by the act either exceeded or matched white turnout in 2012. This ruling recognizes that we've moved on from our unhappy past. We have not, said Joan Walsh in Salon.com. As recently as 2010, Alabama legislators were caught discussing tactics of how to keep African Americans from the polls. The 2012 surge in black turnout was driven by anger over such disgraceful schemes. Now we'll see a new wave of voter ID and other laws designed purely to keep minorities from voting, all thanks to the Supreme Court. The next item from the main story section is stricter affirmative action. The Supreme Court last week raised the bar for considering race in university admissions, ruling that colleges must be able to demonstrate that no workable race-neutral alternatives could be used to achieve diversity. The justices voted 7-1 to send a case challenging the University of Texas's use of race-based affirmative action back to the appeals court for reconsideration. In the majority opinion, Justice Anthony Kennedy wrote that in approving evolving Texas's system of ensuring diversity, the lower court had failed to apply the legal standard of strict scrutiny. Universities that wish to use racial preferences in admissions, he said, must prove that they could not achieve sufficient diversity without using racial classifications. The ruling is expected to set off a flurry of legal challenges to college affirmative action policies. This decision could have been a lot worse, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post. While colleges must now face more rigorous scrutiny of their admissions policies, the court did not rule that any consideration of race was unconstitutional, as many had expected it would. For those who believe America is still not colorblind, it was probably the best we could have hoped for. Affirmative action is now on borrowed time, said NationalReview.com in an editorial. This decision strengthens the court's power to question how colleges use racial preferences, emboldening plaintiffs to bring fresh challenges. That could make race-based admissions policies a costly prospect for universities, and sooner or later, one of those challenges will strike down this discriminatory practice once and for all. Taking race into account was one essential, said John McWhorter in nymag.com. But 40 years is enough. Of course, racism still exists, but implying that minorities can only succeed if given a leg up fosters the low expectations we otherwise rightly call bigotry. Today's underclass comes in all colors, so the only logical, fair, and progressive kind of affirmative action would consider those disadvantaged by economic inequality, not by race. And now we'll turn to the controversy of the week from the main story section of the Week magazine. This article is entitled, Climate Change: Will Obama's Emissions Edict Help? President Obama has just put climate change back on the national agenda, said Mark Tersik in HuffingtonPost.com. Declaring that the U.S. should not condemn future generations to a planet that's beyond fixing, Obama this past week announced a wide-ranging plan to reduce greenhouse gas pollution and prepare the country for a world of rising temperatures. The president said he would use executive authority to bypass a deadlocked Congress and mandate major reductions in carbon emissions from the country's power plants, the bulk of which burn coal and account for roughly one-third of the U.S.'s greenhouse gas production. His ambitious program would free up federal land for new solar and wind energy projects and increase funding to help cities and states adapt to rising sea levels and increasingly extreme weather. Obama's decision to act unilaterally is reason to celebrate, said Jason Bordoff and Michael Levy in the New York Times. But it's also an occasion for mourning. The global atmospheric concentration of carbon dioxide reached a milestone of 400 parts per million in March, the highest in several million years. Yet congressional Republicans continue to insist that no action to restrain emissions is necessary. They're right, said NationalReview.com in an editorial. Contrary to the predictions of climate models, recent scientific research has found that global warming is slowing, and some estimates show it is having been reversed. The warmest year on record was 1998, and for reasons climatologists admit they don't understand, the rate of warming over the last 15 years was markedly lower than in the preceding 20 years. Clearly, the science isn't settled. Hurting our economy to make minor emissions reductions is not justified by science, by economics, or by sensible policy analysis. Obama's plan to single-handedly save Earth without the consent of Congress is grandiose, even for him, said the Wall Street Journal. By declaring war on carbon, Obama will cause higher costs to ripple through the energy chain, the last thing the country needs at a time when the economy remains sluggish and 12 million Americans can't find work. Taking a wait-and-see approach on climate change would be a recipe for certain disaster, said Dana Nucatelli in Guardian.co.uk. It's true that the warming of surface air temperature has slowed, but studies suggest that about 90% of the planet's warming is being absorbed by the oceans. Sooner or later, that stored heat will be unleashed, melting polar ice caps and warming the atmosphere at a suddenly accelerated rate. Any meaningful attempt to prevent this disaster will cause some economic pain, said Matthew Iglesias in Slate.com. But allowing air pollution to continue unabated, locking in a future of rising sea levels, wild storms, heat waves, and floods is much worse for the economic long term than the short-term pain of higher electricity prices. Yet the odds that Obama's initiative will noticeably slow global warming is pretty slim, said Megan McArdle in the DailyBeast.com. The developing world, led by China and India, is building thousands of coal-burning factories, power plants, and cities that will overwhelm any reduction in emissions made by the U.S. And few Americans are actually willing to make the painful lifestyle choices, such as giving up air conditioning and cutting back on air travel, necessary to seriously reduce our open carbon emissions. Without real global cooperation, the president's plan is doomed to be just another footnote in the history of our warming planet. Now we'll turn from the controversy of the week to the very entertaining article entitled A Good Week For and A Bad Week For. It was a good week for holding it in after passengers on an 11-hour flight from San Francisco to London found out shortly after takeoff that United Airlines had forgotten to stock the plane with toilet paper. Flight attendants apologized and handed out tiny cocktail napkins. It was a good week for big game hunting after an Indiana couple shot an animal prowling through their backyard and discovered it was an African leopard. State officials said the big cat was likely an escaped pet since leopards are not native to Indiana. And it was a good week for Ghostbusters after security cameras at a British museum proved that a 4,000-year-old Egyptian statue has been slowly rotating inside its glass display case. Physicists speculated that the movement might be the result of vibrations from people walking by. It was a bad week for collegiality after Justice Samuel Alito, 63, broke the Supreme Court's usual decorum and visibly mocked 80-year-old Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg by rolling his eyes, pursing his lips, and shaking his head as she read an impassioned dissent on a ruling about workplace discrimination. It was a bad week for sticking to the landing, or rather sticking the landing, after Joe Barbera of Washington State climbed to 15,000 feet in a lawn chair attached to balloons, but came down in a tree. He had to be rescued. I guess. It was a bad week for advertising after an Iowa woman was arrested for allegedly posting an ad on Craigslist offering $10,000 to anyone who would kill her father. Usually, this is something that takes place in a seedy bar, said Police Captain Bob Lynn, who utilizes Craigslist. And now we'll turn to the briefing in the Week magazine for this week. The briefing article this week is entitled A Crusader for Human Rights. Samantha Power, Obama's nominee for UN ambassador, is a passionate advocate for U.S. intervention abroad. What is Power's background? An intellectual and a crusader, Samantha Power comes to international diplomacy from the worlds of journalism and academia. She was born in Ireland in 1970 and emigrated to the U.S. with her parents when she was nine. After graduating from Yale in 1992, she got newspaper assignments to cover the wars sparked by the breakup of Yugoslavia. There, she quickly earned respect for being what a fellow journalist described as a flame-haired, freckled girl with guts. Deeply affected by the atrocities committed in Bosnia, Power became known for haranguing senior American officials, for failing to stop massacres, and pushing her editors at the Boston Globe for more space to tell Americans about the horrors she witnessed. She was a force of nature, said fellow reporter Barbara Demick. How did that experience shape her? Power was haunted by the war in Bosnia, especially United Nations troops' failure to prevent the 1995 massacre of more than 8,000 Muslim men and boys at Srebrenica. She returned to the U.S. determined to take an active role in preventing such tragedies. After earning a law degree from Harvard, the self-styled genocide chick set up a human rights center there while continuing to report on atrocities in the Sudan, Zimbabwe, East Timor, and Kosovo. She brought insights from archives and war zones alike to her 2002 book, A Problem from Hell, America and the Age of Genocide, in which she argues that American leaders have consistently chosen to look away from genocide abroad. No U.S. president has ever suffered politically for his indifference to its occurrence, Power wrote. It is thus no coincidence that genocide rages on. Power, who had become a professor at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, won a Pulitzer Prize for the book, as well as the attention of the young new senator from Illinois, Barack Obama. How did they meet? Obama's office called Power out of the blue in 2005, saying that the senator had read her book and wanted to chat. Their scheduled one-hour meeting in Washington stretched into hours of an intense foreign policy discussion. Entering the fourth hour, Power later remembered, I heard myself saying, why don't I quit my job at Harvard and come an intern in your office and answer the phones or do whatever you want? It was literally that spontaneous. She soon became one of Obama's main foreign policy advisors, pushing the cerebral young senator toward her vision of what she called tough, principled, and engaged diplomacy. When Obama ran for president, Power served as the campaign's foreign policy advisor, but her penchant for speaking her mind caught up with her in March 2008 when she told a reporter, in what she thought was an off-the-record comment, that Hillary Clinton, Obama's rival for the Democratic nomination, was a politically ruthless monster. Forced to resign, Power laid low for the rest of Obama's campaign. After he won, she joined his National Security Council. By nominating Power for UN ambassador last month, Obama appears determined to complete her rehabilitation. Would the post give her more sway? Hawks and liberal humanitarians both hope that the promotion of Power, along with the appointment of pro-interventionist Susan Rice as Obama's national security advisor, signals a more aggressive stance on countries like Syria and Iran, especially since both women, close friends of the president, persuaded him to intervene militarily in Libya. But activists may be disappointed. Though often caricatured as a modern-day Joan of Arc, she was plastered on the national interest's front cover under the headline Interventionista. Power has become more pragmatic over the years. She now sees foreign policy as a toolbox that includes international sanctions, travel bans, and asset freezes, as well as military interventions. What do conservatives make of her? Hawks like Senator John McCain support her, anticipating that she'll push a more muscular approach in Syria. But some Republicans call her anti-Israel because of comments she once made about the country's major human rights abuses against the Palestinians. Conservatives also are alarmed by her 2003 call for the U.S. to apologize for its historical crimes, seeing it as evidence of a blame America first attitude. Commentator Glenn Beck has called Power the most dangerous woman in America. Will she be confirmed? Probably so. But Republicans will give her a rough time, using her as a proxy to express their anger that Obama appointed Rice to a powerful post for which needs no Senate confirmation. The GOP believes Rice took part in an administration cover-up of the terrorist involvement in the 2012 attack on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi. If Power is confirmed, the question remains how well this former outsider can promote her ideals from the inside. She is clearly the foremost voice for human rights within the White House, and she has Obama's ear, said Human Rights Watch Executive Director Kenneth Roth. But inside the corridors of Power, she will encounter more directly what she has called an official tendency to favor stopping genocide in the abstract, while simultaneously opposing American involvement in the movement. And the footnote column from this particular briefing section is entitled "The Influence of Women. Have Female Hawks Taken Over Foreign Policy?" One of the arguments for having more women in positions of power is that they'd be less susceptible to military confrontations fueled by testosterone. In practice, female office holders have been anything but pacifists. UN Ambassador and future Secretary of State Madeleine Albright pushed then-Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff Colin Powell to intervene in the Balkans. "What's the point of having this superb military that you're always talking about if we can't use it?" she asked. Likewise, National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice joined the neocons in advocating the Iraq War. Under Obama, Hillary Clinton, Susan Rice, and Samantha Power have been strong advocates of intervention in Libya and Syria. In the Balkans, it took 3 years for the international community to use air power, said Power, in noting that trio's influence. In Libya, it took a little more than 1 month. Now from the Week magazine, we'll turn to the best columns in the U.S. for this past week. Our first one is entitled, "Why I Had a Late-Term Abortion." It was written by Judy Nicastro in the New York Times. "I have a very personal reason for believing late-term abortions must remain legal," said Judy Nicastro. "My husband and I were elated when I became pregnant at 42 with twins, a boy and a girl. But a 20th week ultrasound revealed heartbreaking news. Our boy had a herniated diaphragm, and his organs had been pushed into his chest and weren't developing properly. We desperately wanted this child, but the doctors told us that if he survived birth, he would live only briefly and on massive life support. The thought of hearing him gasp for air and linger in pain was our worst nightmare. So in the 23rd week of my pregnancy, a needle was inserted through my belly into his tiny heart. I was deeply saddened, yet grateful that his ordeal was over. Later, I gave birth to a healthy and beautiful daughter. Pro-lifers in the House of Representatives, who last week voted to ban abortions after 22 weeks, would require that seriously deformed fetuses like my son be born only to suffer. Anyone with true compassion knows that this is an intensely personal decision, and should remain one." The next column is entitled, "So Much for the Russian Reset. by Peter Wehner in CommentaryMagazine.com. Barack Obama's reset with Russia is really going well, don't you think? Said Peter Wehner. In his first term, the president fell all over himself trying to build new bridges to Vladimir Putin's autocratic regime, scrapping a missile defense system in Poland and the Czech Republic that upset the Russians. The U.S. and Russia, Obama explained, would reset their relationship, creating a win-win for both nations. Putin's response to these overtures? Nothing but contempt. Russia this past week thumbed its nose at the U.S. government's demand that it hand over Edward Snowden, who fled to Moscow after being charged with leaking U.S. intelligence secrets. In Syria, Putin continues to defy the West by funneling aid and weapons to the Assad regime. At the G8 meeting last week, a scowling Putin mocked Obama's plan to send arms to the Syrian rebels. Putin also remains supportive of the Iranian regime, defying the West's efforts to curtail its nuclear ambitions. At home, Putin has presided over intense suppression of his political enemies, jailing those who dare to defy him. All told, the Obama reset has been a total failure. Putin is cleaning Obama's clock. The next article is entitled A Movement Based on Obama Hate by Michael O'Donnell in NewRepublic.com. Will the Tea Party outlive Barack Obama's presidency? Said Michael O'Donnell. The evidence suggests that the conservative grassroots movement is motivated less by its small government ideology than it is by a visceral loathing of the president himself. A new study of the Tea Party, Change They Can't Believe In, by political scientist Christopher Parker and Matt Barreto, finds that President Obama symbolizes everything that Tea Partiers dislike about the direction of the country. His race, background, education, and intellectual manner personify in an unavoidable way how America has changed in the past few decades, and remind these white aging rural conservatives that they're being outnumbered. 7 out of 10 Tea Partiers say they literally believe Obama will destroy the country, and 59% believe he is foreign born. Such irrational extremism has damaged the Tea Party's brand, and only 21% of Americans now identify with the movement. But 2016 will prove the real test of the Tea Party's fate. If the mere fact of Obama's departure is sufficient for the Tea Party to declare that they've taken back the country, they'll go down in history as just another reactionary fringe group in silly hats. And now we'll turn to the back of the Week magazine for this week for the article entitled The Last Word. This week's subject is entitled Close to Paradise. As baby boomers retire, says Lisa Marganelli, they may find what they need in mobile home communities. Residents call life at Pismo Dunes Senior Park Pismodice. California is a notoriously youthful culture, but eventually the perpetually young get very old. If they're lucky enough to live in Pismo Dice, a trailer park on the Central Coast, they can exit its palm line entrance, cross the road, amble across the capacious sand of Pismo State Beach, and dip their toes in the Pacific Ocean while contemplating eternity. Or a cocktail. To move into Pismo Dice, you must meet 4 conditions. You must be 55 or older, keep your dog under 20 pounds, be present when guests stay at your home, and be comfortable with what most Americans consider a very small house. If you need more than 800 square feet, I can't help you, says park manager Louise Payne, 72, with a shrug. There seems to be some leeway on the dog's weight. No one in California aspires to be old or to live in a trailer, but we need to be more open to the possibilities inherent in both. Every day since January 1, 2011, some 10,000 American baby boomers have retired, and that will continue until 2030, when people over 65 will make up 19% of the population, up from 13% today. One of the biggest questions facing the nation with regard to aging boomers is, where are they going to live? The options include independent living, nursing homes, aging in place, naturally occurring retirement communities called NORCs, retirement villages, memory care units, age-restricted communities. Seniors who can live on their own cost the country relatively little. They even contribute to the economy. But those who move into nursing homes start to run up a significant tab, starting at $52,000 a year. People who are isolated and lonely end up in nursing homes sooner. Hence, finding ways to keep people living on their own, socially engaged, healthy, happy, and out of care isn't just a personal or family goal, it's a national priority. Among seniors' living options, there is one we overlook: mobile homes. Legal and financially manufactured homes have a second-class existence. They're not treated as real estate, but as chattel or personal property. Owners don't get the same rights or financial benefits as do other homeowners. For this reason, sociologists have described trailer parks as quasi-homelessness and a kind of serfdom. This prejudice prevents us from seeing a modest but otherwise pleasant house. Travel trailers evolved into mobile homes, which eventually lost their wheels and became manufactured housing. By any name, they are the largest source of unsubsidized affordable housing in the country. There are 7 million manufactured homes housing 18 million people. In some countries, they make up 60% of dwellings. Units built since 1976, when the Department of Housing and Urban Development started regulating their construction, can last as long as site-built homes when they're well-built and maintained. Yet they cost far less, $41 per square foot versus $85 per square foot and up. Ernie Link, who is 93 years old, is sitting in front of his trailer, wearing shades and trying to flirt with whoever will play along. "I get slapped a lot, but what the hell," he tells me. His house was originally a small travel trailer, but he's added a sunroom and a carport, now occupied by an electric golf cart. His daughter lives nearby, but he still wants to live alone. Ernie's trailer gives him physical and financial independence. Pismo Beach's residents are 36% seniors, a third of whom live in mobile home parks. In 2010, a city survey found that seniors in mobile homes spent a smaller percentage of their income on housing than renters or homeowners, even though their incomes were lower. The Department of Housing and Urban Development found that mobile home dwellers do substantially better nationally than owners and renters at keeping housing costs below 30% of their income. What surprises me is the wide range of incomes in the park, more than in subsidized housing, for example, or a retirement community. Little trailers like Ernie's nestle next to much more impressive house-like units with bay windows, fancy porches, and nice cars in the drive. Louise tells me that some residents of Pismo Dunes survive on less than $900 a month, while others have monthly incomes of $15,000. For half of the residents, this is their second home. This is not a fluke. While 30% of seniors in mobile homes have assets under $25,000, 9% have more than $250,000, and some have more than $500,000. Just before sunset, Louise and I make our way to the evening's therapy session at Space 329 at the junction of the two biggest streets in the park. Dina and Ronnie Stockton have an elevated porch that allows them to see everyone coming and going. Today's conversation meanders from topic to topic. A neighbor's overweight King Charles Spaniel, the ambulance that came to the park earlier in the day, Dina tells a story about the time a 90-year-old neighbor called to ask for a cup of coffee. Dina made the coffee and dutifully took it across the street, only to discover that the woman had fallen. Turns out she felt better asking for a cup of coffee than a hand to get up. Therapy in these circles is meant as a joke, except it happens to be true. A long-running study of aging found that among the predictors of healthy aging are not smoking, moderate drinking, having five or more friends, avoiding depression, and walking for exercise. Older people who do two out of the three last activities are more likely to spend their next 6 years in a sort of golden old age without becoming dependent upon others or, God forbid, nursing homes for the basics of daily living. In other words, sitting on the porch drinking and yakking is exactly what the doctor suggests. It's also good for all that residents can drink without driving. When I come back to the park just before 7 a.m. the next day, seven women are waiting for me. We set off at a brisk pace, walking all the roads of the park and waving to anyone who's looking out the window or is on the porch. Walking on the smooth and safe streets to the beach and to the market in town is a big part of the culture of Pismo Dunes. This makes park residents exceptional. Less than 25% of older adults say that they walk regularly. Charlie Henson moved in after he retired in 1985. Charlie is active on the residents' committee, cajoling management to improve the park. He makes the rounds, checking on people. He's found several people who had passed away in their homes, and residents check on him. When his wife was ill with cancer, neighbors drop by all the time. Since we've been here all these years, we help each other. Margaret Julkowski walks in, tallish and luminous, in Charlie's dark house. Margaret and Charlie fell in love a year ago, and they still glow. She moved to the park 5 years ago with her husband, who died 6 months later. "People were good to me, even though they didn't know me," she says. One woman convinced her to come to the clubhouse, where she played cards with Charlie and his wife. When Charlie's wife passed away, he and Margaret started taking sandwiches out to where they could look at the ocean. They told me they were amazed to find out that they were in love. And then word traveled fast. Residents gossip that they'd seen Charlie kiss Margaret goodnight. Gossip is the currency of a kind of community that doesn't form on Facebook. Here people watch each other, and they know they're being watched. Bad behavior is noted. People who do the right thing are admired. Pismo Dunes, with its little streets, is a virtuous circle where you can bank social capital. Margaret has a serious respiratory condition, and she'd ended up in the hospital for weeks at a time. Her daughter had qualms about letting Margaret move back to the park, but when she saw the parade of visitors, some carrying food, she realized Margaret was likely in the best hands there. And another thing that unites Pismo Dice is death. Outside, dying is essentially a taboo topic. Here, people bring it up in one way or another every 15 minutes. Margaret and Charlie shared the death of their spouses as well as their current lives. "I've never been in such a vibrant, deathy place. We're living to the fullest because we know mortality is close," Margaret tells me. Mobile home parks can, for some seniors, do a better job of meeting needs than more traditional arrangements in apartment buildings or in the suburbs. The design of the community allows seniors to own and modify their homes, have dogs, and putter around with hobbies like gardening in a way they couldn't in an apartment building. Meanwhile, because parks have boundaries and streets, they function a bit like a gated community, where residents feel safe and have an easier time making friends than in either an apartment or a suburb. Mobile home parks give residents a lot of control over their desire to be alone or to be social. But Buyer beware. All is not right in the mobile home parks. Residents have to contend with a parallel world of second-class legal rights and financing that needs to be changed before manufactured homes are a really good investment. The legal problems start with the parks themselves. Because most residents own their homes but not the land under them, they have the rights of neither renters nor homeowners. Residents don't really have the ability to move if landlords raise rents, because moving a full-size manufactured home can cost as much as $25,000. The financial system, meanwhile, treats manufactured homes more like cars than houses, which means they depreciate like cars rather than gaining value the way houses do. Even though manufactured homes last as long as conventional site-built houses, they start losing value as soon as the buyers move in. And that's too bad, because in many cases, new manufactured housing can solve another problem. They offer greener housing than other options. A 2012 report found that mobile homes use, on average, far less energy and water than conventional homes or condos. While models built before 1976, when federal regulations kicked in, sometimes have exorbitant utility bills, newer models made to Energy Star efficiency standards can reduce the combined costs of electricity, gas, and water so well below $1,000 a year that even in the hottest and coldest parts of the country. When I went back to visit with Charlie and Margaret, she was thin and weak, preparing to go back to the hospital. Margaret told me that they were blessed to have found each other, and we always say how blessed we are to have reasonable rent of $400 to $450 a month, this close to the ocean, she added. I don't know where we could live for that much unless it was subsidized senior housing. And as someone who worked for the welfare department, I never wanted to live in one of those places. And that was by Lisa Marganelli, copyrighted 2013 by the Pacific Standard. Now, from the last word, we'll move on to the talking points section of the Week magazine. Our first article in this particular section is entitled, Dean, Should the N-Word Be Unforgivable? Well, 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 the fried chickens have come home to roost, said Jamila Lemieux in Ebony.com. Paula Deen, the butter and cream-loving chef who built a million-dollar empire on artery-clogging southern recipes, was dropped by the Food Network last week over a taped court deposition in which she admitted having occasionally used the N-word. Deen gave the deposition as part of a discrimination lawsuit filed against her and her brother, Bubba Hears, by a former manager at their restaurant in Savannah. In her deposition, Deen also admitted to having wanted a Southern plantation-themed wedding for her brother with an all-black waitstaff. Deen begged for forgiveness when the deposition became public, but the big old bigot is only sorry she got caught. Deen can take her deep-fried, bacon-wrapped, cheese-covered sorry and go. Deen deserves another chance, said Charles C.W. Cook in the NationalReview.com. She's 66 and grew up in the Old South, when language that's totally unacceptable today was commonplace. Many other public figures have survived using slurs, from Jesse Jackson's Hymie Town to TV comedian Bill Mayer's use of the C-word to describe Sarah Palin. Retards for special needs kids, and rednecks for half the population. Why must the N-word be a career ender, but not retard or the other word with the C? The N-word now has a unique status in our culture, said John McWhorter in Time.com. It's so taboo that if uttered by a white person even once, under any circumstances, it immediately leads to the social equivalent of the death penalty. But when taboo enforcement becomes this harsh and unforgiving, it is not thought, but sport. I'd give her a pass on the racial slurs, said Dwayne Wickham in USAtoday.com, but her repeated use of the word butter should have gotten her fired a long time ago. The Southern Belle's biggest crime by far is that she has gotten rich, hawking, calorific, gooey butter cakes, fried butter balls, and glazed donut cheeseburgers in a nation with a growing obesity epidemic. She kept peddling her life-shortening gluttony even after discovering she has type 2 diabetes, a disease fueled by high-fat, high-sugar recipes like hers. Dean then quietly went on a diet and got even richer by becoming the commercial face for a pharmaceutical company that sells a type 2 diabetes drug. It is for her self-serving, hypocritical indifference to her viewers' well-being that she should be run off of TV. The next article from the Talking Points section is the IRS, end of a scandal. Remember the IRS scandal, said Alex Seitzwald in Salon.com. For more than a month, Republicans have been insisting that the agency deliberately targeted Tea Party groups seeking tax-exempt status for special harassment, openly suggesting it was acting on White House orders. Turns out that the whole scandal is entirely bogus, false, a fiction. Newly released transcripts of testimony from an IRS official in Cincinnati show that the decision to target groups was made locally, not by IRS officials in Washington. But the final nail in the coffin was this week's news that liberal groups with keywords like progressive and Occupy in their names were also targeted for special review. So no Nixonian political vendetta. Just the IRS trying to cope with an avalanche of 40,000 applications by partisan organizations seeking tax-exempt status. This should put the matter to bed forever. The IRS scandal is very much alive, said Eliana Johnson in TheNationalReview.com. While the tax agency's infamous Be on the Lookout list is broader than previously thought, most of the groups targeted were affiliated with the Tea Party. The testimony also indicates that higher-ups in Washington did get involved in the reviews to an extent that remains unknown. More importantly, the IRS's campaign against Tea Party groups may have changed the outcome of the presidential election, said Peggy Noonan in the WSJ.com. The Tea Party was a fierce force in the 2010 midterms when Republicans took back the House. The American Enterprise Institute estimates that if new Tea Party groups hadn't been hampered, they would have generated as many as 8.5 million Republican votes in the presidential election, enough for Mitt Romney to beat Obama. That's laughable, said David Weigel in Slate.com. The Tea Party was extremely active in the 2012 elections, organized by groups such as FreedomWorks and Americans for Prosperity, which had charitable tax status for years. Ah, but we are now officially in the post-fact phase of this scandal, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. Republicans have retreated to insisting that Obama has to prove he was not involved, or they can assume he was. Most Americans will see through this, but in their fever swamps, conservatives will continue to whisper IRS to other members of the tribe, the way liberals like to say Halliburton during the Bush years, to signal some dark beliefs they don't need to back up. The next article here is entitled Immigration, the $30 billion border surge. America is in the grip of southern border derangement disorder, said Lawrence Downs in NYTimes.com. The Senate approved an amendment to the Gang of Eight immigration bill this past week, calling for a border surge to assuage Republican fears that granting legal status to the nation's 11 million illegal immigrants would encourage a new wave of border crossers. The $30 billion plan by Senators Bob Corker, the Republican from Tennessee, and John Hoeven Republican from North Dakota, would nearly double the Border Patrol from 21,000 agents to 40,000, add 700 miles of fencing, and buy drones and helicopters, underground sensors, and other surveillance technology. This is sheer lunacy, given that illegal crossings are already at a 40-year low. Besides, the new Berlin Wall is meant to repel not terrorists, but nannies, fruit and vegetable harvesters, and hotel maids who want to fill jobs no Americans want. But maybe the border surge is good news anyway, since it may finally get this bill through the Senate. The excessive flamboyant nature of the Hovenkorker approach is the entire point, said Jay Bookman in AJC.com. Since the bipartisan group of senators called the Gang of Eight first introduced the immigration reform bill, Republican hardliners have insisted on tougher border security. Now they've got it in absurd excess, and if they still balk, they might as well admit they want 11 million people to remain in the shadows as a permanent underclass for the rest of their lives. Perhaps the border surge was the only way to give Republicans cover with their base, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. But throwing $30 billion at the Marshall defense of 1,969 miles in the middle of nowhere is hardly an exercise in conservative restraint. The surge may be a masterpiece of public relations, said Fred Bauer in NationalReview.com, but once Congress grants amnesty, the fortified border plan could easily be canceled. The new version of the bill would also do nothing to stop the 40% of illegal immigrants who get here by overstaying work visas. Worse, it invites millions of additional low-skill workers to come here to fill jobs Americans need, pushing down wages and keeping unemployment rates high. Yes, it may be ultimately necessary to legalize those who broke our nation's laws, but until there's a bill that truly prevents more illegal immigration from happening, Republicans should vote no. Now a couple of short items as we reach the end of our program for this week. Donors representing 0.01% of the U.S. population contributed 28% of the $6 billion spent on the 2012 elections, a new report found. A total of 31,385 wealthy donors together gave $1.68 billion. The share of children living in poverty in the U.S. rose to 23% in 2011, mostly because of their parents' long-term unemployment, according to a new study. In 2005, only 19% of children lived in poverty. The upcoming birth of Prince William and Kate Middleton's child is expected to generate a $380 million bump for the British economy, including the sale of millions of souvenirs and trinkets and the opening of an estimated 3 million bottles of sparkling wine. And Americans own nearly 300 million firearms, a new national study found. This translates to nearly 9 guns for every 10 people, a per capita ownership rate nearly 50% higher than any other countries. And now for the poll watch for this week. The U.S. is less concerned about climate change than any other part of the world, with only 40% of Americans viewing it as a major threat, compared with 54% of people around the world. And only 30% of Americans say they feel engaged or inspired at work. 50% say they have checked out at work, and 18% say they are actively disengaged, acting out their unhappiness and undermining their co-workers. We've just about run out of time for today's program of The Week magazine. Be sure to listen again next week. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of The Week magazine. The program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.